This has been a great city for me, and it's a place I wanted to be, and it's all they ever did was ask, you sure you want to be here? I assure you I want to be here. I want to thank the Hamilton Tiger Cats for allowing me to do what I want to do when I want to do it, and then fire me.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham.
Michael, you have some explaining to do, sir. You caused a bit of a firestorm this past weekend. You were pictured in an Edmonton Eskimos jersey, and I can tell you that my phone and my Twitter DMs and the tweets came at me fast and furious. What the hell is going on out there?
Okay, so they're playing the Argos, people. That's all I have to say. I know that's not an excuse, but I have many CFL jerseys, okay? Let's see, I have Montreal, I have BC, I have Saskatchewan, I have an Edmonton, I have a Calgary. You know, I'm a CFL fan. I'm a Ticats fan, obviously. Number one is Ticats. But if you're going to, going to Commonwealth Stadium, they're playing the Argos. I was just trying to fit in with everyone. It's just a little bit of peer pressure, maybe.
Oh, you're kind of forced into wearing it?
No, not forced. I just wanted to blend in with everyone, and root against the Argos.
Look, I understand rooting against the Argos. I went to a Argos Riders game in 2007, and this was before I really hated the Saskatchewan Roughriders all that much, but I didn't wear a Riders jersey. I'm pretty sure it was like a red t-shirt and a pair of black shorts, and I cheered against the Argos, but I wasn't wearing a Riders jersey. Don't worry, it's a pardonable sin. We can forgive and forget. Just maybe keep the pictures out of it, because people were mad at you, buddy. Mad.
I understand. Yeah, it was fired on. It was put up there for everyone to see, so it's okay. I'm not turning my Ticats colors in. I'm just cheering against the Argos. That's all.
It was a one-shot deal.
Yes.
Okay. I think we can deal with that. I think we can accept that excuse. I'll accept that excuse. I rescind my firing.
I was wearing a Ticats hat, if you noticed. I was wearing a Ticats hat.
Okay. So you're... Yes. Okay. It's all cool. All cool on this end. We're good.
Yeah.
All right. So while you were out there in Edmonton, sort of half becoming an Eskimos fan, the night before, I got to meet the legend himself, Angelo Moscovite, and I was lucky enough to meet the man, and I'm kind of speechless. Every Ticat fan seems to have an Angelo Mosca story, and I was lucky enough on Thursday to make mine. It was a short, brief meeting. I got a chance to sit in his booth, shake his hand, tell him that it was an honor to meet him. Got a jersey signed for a friend of mine. Got a picture taken with him and myself that is now my Twitter profile picture, and it's going to take something monumentous to replace that picture. It was just I can't even imagine. I saw myself like. I'm at a loss for words. I'm stuttering. I'm stammering. It was amazing. I don't know if you've ever had a chance to meet Angelo Mosca, but my big takeaway from him is the man has hands like bear paws. Just still, even in his like mid 70s, he's just larger than life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, when I went to the Moncton game, it was Ticats and Stamps, I think he came to town, and he was actually staying in my hotel. So we went for breakfast. I think it was the day of the game. We were sitting right beside him having breakfast. I don't know why, but I was too nervous to say anything to him. But yeah, I was up close and personal. I didn't talk to him or anything, but it must have been great to shake his hand on his night. And I was happy that they showed the ceremony at halftime on TSN, so that was really cool to watch.
They showed the whole thing, eh?
Yep.
That is pretty cool, because that is a monumentous moment in not only Ticats history, but CFL history in general. Like I said, larger than life. Man, just the epitome of Hamilton defense from when he played. Just he is Mr. Ticat. I think we've talked about this a few times before when his name has come up. He's the living legend, and yeah, I will cherish that memory for as long as I am around. You should have taken your advantage and said something to him when you had a chance to see him, because when I went up to him, he was very gracious and said he loved meeting fans. So you probably could have had yourself a nice story, but hey, at least you got to sit up close and personal near him. And that's pretty cool, too.
Yeah, I eavesdropped on this conversation a bit, so yeah, it was good.
Hopefully you didn't hear anything too salacious.
Nope.
Unfortunately, we now have to talk about the game that was played on Angelo Mosca night, and just a putrid, pathetic performance, I think, by the Ticats. I sat there in the stands watching the game, and at no point did I really think that they were in it. The very first play of the game, offensively, they get called for pass interference, and that to me set the tone for the rest of the game. It was just a sloppy performance. I don't know. You take it from here. I'm just too frustrated with what happened to really go on.
Well, yeah, it was a slow start for them for sure, and they, Montreal came out with that screen pass to either Rutley or Sutton, I can't remember which one, but it worked to perfection against the Ticats blitz, and it seemed from then on they had their number. Even though it was close most of the game, and they did have a chance at the end of the game to tie it, it was it was their worst performance of the season so far.
It just seems like Montreal has their number, eh?
Yeah. And the, you just can't give up six sacks. I mean, that was ridiculous. The Montreal blitzes with the linebackers were fooling the offensive line all night long. And Claros was had happy feet all game long, looking nervous. And you just can't have that many sacks. It was just ridiculous.
The two things that they had done pretty excellently up until this point was, like you said, protect the quarterback, which they did not do, and stopping the run. They gave up 130 yards rushing. Mm-hmm. Against Montreal, which was by far their highest total of the season. Like I said, they just didn't seem into it from the start of the game. But it was near the end of the game. The final drive, they were driving. I think it was Sinkfield picked up a nice chunk of yards to get mm-hmm. them near around, a little past midfield. I think they were in Montreal territory even. And then the very next play, they do this handoff with like 45 seconds left to Grigsby, and they lose 4 yards. The next play is the interception. Mm-hmm. They hadn't really run the ball all night. They haven't really run the ball well all year. Why, with less than a minute left, are you running Grigsby off tackle to the weak side? Like, it was just a boneheaded play call, and I was sitting there watching it just, like, dumbfounded. We were all, like, everyone who was around me was just like, that was the stupidest thing I've ever seen. The Ticats have this tendency to get too cute sometimes, and I think that was one of those times when it's like, you know, put Caleros back in the shotgun and just gun it down the field. They were maybe two or three plays from getting a reasonable crack at the end zone, mm-hmm. and they were going to be, you know, they were first down or so away from being well within Medlock's field goal range. I just don't understand what they were thinking handing the ball off to Grigsby in that situation.
Especially, like, kind of a sweep play, too, and up to the side, running play. Like, run it up the middle if you're going to run it. Just don't lose any yards, because I'm not sure exactly where they were, but it was probably in Medlock's field goal range. Like, no guarantee he would have hit that long field goal, but he can make it. And I thought that Grigsby was a little slow. Like, he had a block when he was running to the side, and he kind of, like, I don't know if he was trying to be patient to make it, you know, something to open up, but he should have just gunned it around that guy and, you know, got what he could. So I don't like the play either, and I didn't like how Grigsby ran with the ball.
What do you make of some of the missed calls that have sort of perpetuated Ticats' social media and the forums? The no-yards call that was not called on the Brandon Banks punt that became the fumble that the Owls then took down and scored. Mm-hmm. And the block in the back on Rutley's TD catch, which you brought up earlier, that cameras caught, I think it was Philip Blake, legitimately shoving Mike Daly right in the back, and that's essentially what sprung Rutley. Personally, I'm not going to say that these missed calls were the reason the Ticats lost the game. They did enough on their own to lose this game, but they sure didn't need the Zebras sort of handing Montreal a couple of key scores there. I just didn't like it.
Both big plays, you both factored into the game. I think it was Chip Cox that was probably 3 yards away when Banks had that face fumble. So, you know, if that they call that, Ticats have the ball, no touchdown on that drive for Montreal, and then the Rutley play, there's no touchdown because if they call that, then the play's coming back. Two huge plays. I'm not going to say that it caused the loss for the Ticats, but it sure didn't help.
My thoughts exactly. It definitely didn't cause the loss. Like I said, the Ticats played bad enough on their own with, like you said earlier, giving up six sacks. Like I said, giving up 130 yards on the ground. Not really getting any pressure on either Montreal quarterback. And the thing was, is, you know, Cato goes down. I think it was on the one sack the Ticats actually had. Eric Norwood took him down, and Cato looked to do something to his knee or his ankle. Like, I don't really know what it was. And then Tanner Marsh comes in, and you bring a backup like that in, you kind of expect, you know, the Ticats to release the hounds and go after this kid. And, you know, Montreal's offensive line, maybe they came in with a chip on their shoulder after all the talk about how good Hamilton's defense was, but they, you know, held the vaunted Hamilton defensive line and that Hamilton defense in check all night.
Yeah, Montreal's, they got quite the running game going on with multiple players. I mean, they handed it off to Jaguar a couple times, and they got Rutley, and then they got Sutton. So as soon as Cato went down, I thought, okay, Marsh is coming in. This game's over. Ticats are going to win because I am not a big fan of Marsh. He had that one game when it was like, Marsh Madness or whatever against the BC Lions last year or 2 years ago. I can't really remember, but I mean, he threw four picks in that game too, so I don't see what the big huff was about him. He just got lucky, in my opinion, in that game. So as soon as Cato went down, I was like, yeah, this game's over. But Marsh played decent, and they had a great running game, and they snuck away with a victory.
You know what the one takeaway I have from this, though, is that I'm not sitting here worried that this is sort of the beginning of the end for the team. Like, all the negatives that came from that game, everything that they did well during their five-game win streak, they did terribly in Thursday's game. But I'm sitting here going, okay, it's a loss. It sucked. But I'm not sitting here going, oh my God, so this is going to be the start of a 5-6-game losing streak, and the Cats are going to go back under 500. And I have confidence that this team will turn it around. And this is not something that I have usually felt with Ticat teams in the past. It's kind of weird. Do you sort of feel the same way? Are you not really worried that this will be sort of the first shoe to fall, and then all of a sudden this team's going to not remember how to win?
No, I think they'll come out guns a-blazing against the Argos. I think they'll really get up for that game after that loss. And, Labor Day, of course. Labor Day game, they always get up for that no matter what. So I think they'll answer back with a win against the Argos next week and then go from there. I mean, we're still 6-3. If you would have said to me, by Labor Day you'll be 6-3, I would have took that without question. So, no, I totally think they'll bounce back after this.
I've said about all is I want to say about this game. If you got anything left that you want to tack on here, go nuts. But I'm pretty much tapped out on this. I'm moving on. I'm getting ready for Labor Day and what's hopefully a sound, solid beating by the Ticats against the Argos.
There was one thing there. There was a horse collar tackle call. And I thought about this before in games. And do you think it should be called a horse collar tackle if the guy's not actually tackled?
It is hilarious that you bring that up, because that's the exact same conversation I had with my friend in the stands when the flag went. We were all sitting there going, yeah, we know it's the rule, but can you really call it a horse collar tackle if the guy's not tackled? Just call it a horse collar. And someone who sits, I think he was either sitting in front of us or beside us, I don't really remember, it was someone somewhere, actually it might have even been my friend that I was sitting with, mentioned Fitwell face mask doesn't always tackle a guy, but they call it. And someone I was sitting with was like, well, yeah, but if it's not called a face mask tackle, it's called a face mask. If they want to get that out of the game and just not have anyone reach at the top of the jersey, because that's essentially what it was. I don't think whomever the Ticats tackler was got inside the shoulder pads. Like, initially, that's what the rule was for. It was reaching inside the jersey and pulling a player backwards. Now it's essentially been called a flag on any sort of touching whatsoever when they bring their hand up above, say, the nameplate, if you will. But no, I understand that is the rule. But yeah, it just seems silly to call it a horse collar tackle when the guy breaks the tackle and gains like 10 or 12 more yards. I just don't get it either.
Yeah, I don't know if there's like a 5-yard penalty you could call if you just grab it. But I don't know. Then it might get too complicated. But it just seems silly that if the player isn't brought down, then
how can you call it a tackle?
Yeah.
So ends the Ticats' home winning streak. We should bring that up. They have finally now lost to Tim Hortons Field. 10-1. Still, you know what? I will take it. It's like you said, the team is now 6-3. And if you'd have told me at the beginning of the season, like just like yourself, 6-3 at Labor Day, yeah, I'd be pretty happy. So I am pretty happy, but that streak ends. And another streak ends, our being close to or nailing our bowl predictions. We were so off once again. We're back to where we used to be. You, sir, had Nick Grigsby rushing for 100-plus yards and getting a touchdown on the ground and a touchdown through the air. And I didn't even bother to look up what his numbers were, but I know they were nowhere near 100 yards. Do you have them handy by any chance?
Yep. 3 carries for 11 yards.
Wow. 3 carries for 11 yards. And I said the Ticats will hold the Owls to under 10 points, and the Owls had 10 points before the end of the first quarter, so that's a big old strike for me. But hopefully we'll be a little bit better when we pick our bold predictions later in the show for the Argos game, and hopefully the Ticats will play a better game when they meet the Argos. Let's move on, shall we?
We shall.
Big news out of Saskatchewan that just broke. The Saskatchewan Roughriders have fired head coach Corey Chamblin and general manager, Brendan Taman. I should say, for those who are listening before the show, Mike and I, we converse a little bit. And I said I was keeping Twitter open on the off chance that they would fire them, but I thought it was unlikely, seeing as how late in the day it was. And as soon as I said that, what was it, 5 seconds later, I checked, and boom. Yeah. They were both fired, so I guess that's another one where I was wrong. But are you really surprised that these guys were let go?
No, not the way that the season has gone for the Rough Riders. I mean, Chamberlain seemed to have been making dumb decision after dumb decision. You know, seemed to have a huge ego. You know, nothing he did was wrong. You know, it was always someone else's fault and blah, blah, blah. So I said in an earlier show that I thought that he had a lot of rope. And it wouldn't happen until maybe the end of the season, but it's just been such a shit show in Saskatchewan that something had to be done. I'm a little surprised that Taman was gone too, but you know, I guess he brought those players in and they haven't been performing, so not really surprised, especially after last week's loss.
Yeah, the one against Ottawa. We're going to get into that a little bit later, but another bit of news is who will be replacing them. Got any guesses as to who you think the interim GM and interim head coach might be for Saskatchewan?
Well, that's a tough... Maybe Paul Lapalisse as head coach. I'm just throwing a name out there that I can't stuff for right off the top of my head. I can't really think of a GM. Do you have gotten anybody in mind?
Well, I have the names here, so I can't really guess, because I would just guess the names that are actually in front of me and be like, oh, I was right. But anyway, the interim general manager will be Jeremy O'Day, and the interim head coach is Bob Dice. So they stayed in-house, which tells me that they're going to look in the offseason for a new general manager and a new head coach. This is definitely just a temporary move.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't really know what to say. These two guys led this team to a Grey Cup not two seasons ago, but if we're being completely honest, they loaded up for that championship. They brought in veteran players. G. Roy Simon was brought in. Ricky Foley was brought in. They got John Chick back from the NFL. They really sort of sold the future to make sure that they won that Grey Cup in their hometown. So it's been a gong show there pretty much since, what would you say, Durant's injury last year. They're something like 2-17 or something like that. And like, they've just been terrible. And some of the decisions, and one decision in particular that we're going to talk about when we discuss our the other games of the week, just mind-bogglingly stupid that this team has made. And if not now, then these guys are going to make it to the end of the season. But I'm not surprised at all that these guys are gone.
Yeah, it makes you think where Chamberlain and Taman go next, because I don't know if there's many openings on any CFL team, but I wonder if their future, maybe Chamberlain finds a coordinator job or something, but I guess it'll be interesting to see in the future where they end up.
Yeah, I could see him going back into the coordinator ranks. He's got a Grey Cup ring. He has head coaching experience. He has defensive coordinator experience. He has positional coach experience. I don't think he'll be out of work for long. Taman, on the other hand, again, probably will find himself somewhere. Like, the CFL tends to recycle guys a lot, so I doubt they'll be out of work for the rest of their lives. But I'm not sure about Taman, but I know Chamberlain signed some huge extension, so this is not a cheap move by the Riders. They must have really wanted him gone.
Seems that way.
Now we usually go to the games, and we usually do them in chronological order. Should we talk about the Riders and Red Blacks and just get all the Rider stuff out of the way right now and just forget about it, and we can get into everything else?
Yeah, all right. Let's do that.
Your question to me. Fire it off.
What in the hell was Chamberlain thinking, taking out Smith and replacing him with Sinceri?
This is funny. As you know, like I said earlier, Mike and I talked before the show, and my question to Mike was going to be, what the was Chamberlain thinking? That was going to be my question. Mike sent me his, so I decided to give him a different one that we'll get to in a second. But like I said, stupid decisions that this team has made, that was one of them. I just do not understand. Yeah, he threw a bad interception, but he's a young quarterback. You don't do that to a young quarterback. You leave him in there, you let him learn from his mistakes. It's not like this team was 8-0 and, you know, oh my god, that interception, and that's going to cost us the game, and that's going to cost us a perfect season. They're winless. So you grow with these players. You let a guy like Smith make mistakes and then try to bounce back from. That's what makes quarterbacks mentally tough. And then to replace him with Sinceri, who I mentioned gong show earlier, he is like gong show personified. Just how he still has a job and how he is still collecting paychecks as a professional quarterback in any league, let alone the second best pro league in the world, is beyond me. He is just not a professional caliber quarterback. He holds on to the ball too long. I know that Ottawa had 10 sacks yesterday. Sunseri probably took the majority of them. He's just not good enough. And to yank your young rookie quarterback like that for making just one mistake, it just was stupid. To me, that might have been the straw that broke the camel's back and why we just talked about the fact that the head coach was fired.
Yeah, you got to leave Smith in there. I mean, it was 14-10 or something. He's been playing well. He's a young guy. He put Sinceri in there, which is, I mean, he makes this, he has the brain power of a titmouse, I swear. Like, his decisions are so slow. He just never gets rid of the football. It's ridiculous. You know what he is. Why bring him in? Your best chance to win is with Smith. Just leave him in there. Let him do his thing. And they might have even got the win, but Chamberlain just, I guess there was some dispute between Chamberlain and Smith when he took him out, and that made Chamberlain not bring him back in. So it's just his ego again getting in the way of victory.
Let's forget the Riders now. Here's my question to you. At 5-4, can Ottawa surpass either Toronto or Hamilton and actually host a playoff game this year?
I'm going to say not Hamilton, maybe Toronto. You know, they came into Edmonton this week, and maybe that's what they showed their true colors, and that's what they are, because they took a pounding from the Eskimos. So maybe they fall back down to earth a bit after that game.
Okay, can we pause for 1 second? And remember last week on the show how I said I didn't think the Argos were an elite team and that I would change my opinion if they were able to make some sort of big comeback or beat the Eskimos last week?
Yeah.
What happened? They got down. They didn't get down by a bunch, but they got down early. I think they were down 14-0 at one point, made a bit of a comeback, got it close, and then what did Edmonton do? They beat the brakes off them. That's the Toronto team that I was talking about. Look, they've now had blowout losses to Hamilton and Edmonton on the road, and they could not make a comeback against a Calgary team who at the time was not playing very well. Right now, Calgary looks hotter than the fires of hell. So if Toronto was to play them now, I think they'd get smoked. So that's the Argos team I was talking about last week. I just wanted to get that out there because I took a little bit of flack for not respecting the Argos and their, at the time, 6-2 record. But I think we've seen their true colors. They're a good team, like I said last week, but not a great team. Sorry for the interruption. Continue your thought.
I think Ottawa and Toronto are both good teams, and either of them could finish in the playoffs. They could both make the playoffs. You never really know, because maybe there's a crossover from the East to the West this year with Montreal. Or maybe Montreal's found their stride with that big win against Hamilton, and they start turning it on and climb up to second, or maybe even first. I don't know about that. But yeah, I could see Ottawa surpassing Toronto. Not the Ticats, but maybe Toronto.
I feel the same way. I said at the beginning of the year that I thought Ottawa was going to make the playoffs and win a playoff game, but I think that they have a legitimate shot to take out the Argos. They've already lost once, but it was in Toronto. They still get them, I believe, one more time in Ottawa. So Ottawa's a game back of the Argos right now and a game back of Hamilton. I still think, maybe we're homers, but I do still think the Ticats will find a way to win this division and probably win it pretty handily. So it's going to come down to Ottawa and Toronto, I think, for that second seed. And I think the Red Blacks can do it. I will say this, like I said last week, you asked me about, we had talked about crossovers, and I think, without a doubt, all four teams in the East are making the playoffs, because now you got Saskatchewan, who now, even at 0-9, they are done. They've made a coaching change. They've made a general manager change. They will be lucky if they win four games this year. They are out. BC and Winnipeg. Winnipeg without Willie just isn't very good. So that's another team that either Ottawa or Montreal could surpass. And BC, will they be able to turn it around and get enough wins to knock off one of those teams from coming over? I don't know. Like, right now, the Alouettes sit in third place in the West Division. If the playoffs started today, and like I'm fond of saying, I'm well aware that they don't, Ottawa's heading to Edmonton to take on the Eskimos in the West semi. So I don't see that changing. I think Montreal is better than all three of those teams in the West that I just talked about. And I think Ottawa is better than two. So I think we're seeing a crossover.
Yeah. And I always thought that Montreal had a really good team. They just needed that quarterback to get the offense really flowing. And with their run game, like, they could go into the West and maybe even win a playoff game if they're the crossover team. And so it should be very intriguing to see how all this ends up, because an Eastern crossover would just be so odd to see.
So let's move on to Edmonton's thrashing over the Argos that I sort of touched upon earlier. My question to you after this game is about Darrell Walker, the coming from out of nowhere amazing receiver for the Edmonton Eskimos. Do you think he's a flash in the pan, or is he the next receiving star in the CFL?
I don't think he's a flash in the pan. I think he's in three games now. I've watched him in all three. I watched him on TV the one game when Bowman went down. He came in and was pretty much the number one guy. Then I saw him twice live, and he's just, you know, he's just making plays. You throw him the ball, he's going to make the catch. He's gonna make yards. You know, he's just a good receiver, and he is the number two guy for Edmonton right now behind Bowman, and he's just doing a great job. You got Bowman, you got Kendall Lawrence, who can be a slot back. He's a dangerous player, and you got Walker and Devon Bailey, who I really like. He's the Canadian receiver.
Don't forget Kenny Stafford.
Kenny Stafford, yep. So, you know, maybe Kenny Stafford's number two and Walker's number three. But, yeah, I think he's the real deal, and I think they got a pretty good receiving core in Edmonton.
Well, here's where Walker stands after three games. He is 11th in the league in receiving yards. He has 472 yards in three games, which is 157 yards per game average. His lowest single game total is 125 yards, and he has at least one catch of 30 plus yards in each game. He is getting it done. This sort of reminds me of what Aaron Rodgers did at the end of last season, where he kind of came out of nowhere and posted these massive games. I don't think he's going to be able to sustain 157 yards a game over the course of the season, but nearly 500 yards in three games? Wow. Just wow. I think this kid is going to be a major, major star in Edmonton. The weapons they have on offense, and now that they have a quarterback who can play, this Labor Day game coming up between them and the Stamps is going to be a treat.
Well, I guess I'll just go into the question for you. If Franklin plays well the next couple of games, do you ride the hot hand when Riley is healthy and start Franklin, or is Riley the number one guy no matter what?
This is tough. I don't normally like to say that a guy will lose his job due to injury, but we've seen countless times where guys have done that. I think
that's a rule they say, but it's not really a rule.
If that was a rule, we'd never know who Tom Brady was. You know what I mean? Yeah. I still think that you got to play Riley. If he wasn't hurt, he'd be the starter. And frankly, James Franklin would be on the practice roster still, because you'd have Jordan Lynch is usually their number three quarterback because he's on punt duties, and Nichols would be the backup, and we wouldn't know how bad Nichols really is if he hadn't got a chance to play. I really, really, really like James Franklin. I cannot stress that enough, but I think when Riley comes back, especially near the end of the season, I think you got to play him. Like, he got them to the West final last year, and he did that hobble. Yeah, unless Franklin does, like, if he's going at like a ridiculous pace, they've won like five or six in a row, and he's throwing 300 yards a game, maybe then you consider sort of keeping Riley until he's like fully healthy. But I don't think this is a Trevor Harris, Ricky Ray situation where there's a lot of discussion over who to start. I think you got to put Riley back in there.
Yeah, I think Riley comes in, he'll be the starter again, but he won't, if he's not playing well, I don't think they'll hesitate to put Franklin in there, because he's moving this offense. You know, before the season, you know, we both predicted Edmonton and Hamilton in the Grey Cup. And with Franklin at the helm, they've got the defense, and then they got the offense moving. So they're living up to their expectations with Franklin behind center. So I think Riley will get his job back. If he doesn't move the ball like Franklin was moving the ball, then they'll give him the yank.
I think we've said all we can on this one. Let's move on to the Stampeders shellacking the Blue Bombers. There's not really much we can say about Calgary other than it looks like they're hitting their stride. But there was an interesting thing that came up for me in the game, and it was on Calgary's first touchdown. They went for 2 points. It was 6-0, and they still won for two. John Huffnagel's team has gone for two the most out of any team in the CFL. They've gone 11 times. They've converted 10 of those, a 91% success rate. They went for two twice against Winnipeg later in the game. I think it was Jeff Fuller caught a two-point conversion. Only three teams in the CFL are better at 1 point conference than Calgary is at two, and it's Hamilton, Ottawa, and Saskatchewan. So my question to you is, should every other team follow John Huffnagel's lead and go for two more often?
Not every team. You got situations like Liam Haralahu in Winnipeg where, I mean, the guy hits 50-yard field goals in a game but can't seem to hit that single from 32. So, like, it depends on the team. You know, if you don't trust in your kicker as much, go for two. Go for two because, you know, the percentages are pretty good going for 2 points this year. I think Calgary's at about 70% going for two.
They're at 91%.
Okay, maybe that was the whole league then.
I think you're right. I think it is the whole league.
So depending on the team, you know, for Calgary, it's been working like amazingly. So keep doing it. But if you have a kicker like Medlock or Swayze Waters that you have a lot of confidence in, you don't really need to go for two, then take the single. But if you're clicking at that rate, why not go for two?
Like you said, certain situations, I think teams, Winnipeg being the key one, just go for two every bloody time because Hirilahu has been just atrocious on extra points. Another team that's been pretty bad on extra points this year has been Montreal. They are only 9 of 13. I think they upped that. These are as of last week, so I don't have this week's numbers yet. These are as of last week. They're also below 70% in singles made. But the thing that stuck out to me, and we're kind of veering off topic a little bit here. I do think teams should go for two more, so let's get that out. But I was looking at conversions. Hamilton has scored 31 extra points with one miss. So they've scored 32 touchdowns where they've gone for one afterwards. They've scored 2 points twice on two attempts. So going into the game against Montreal this week, they had scored 34 touchdowns. No other team is anywhere near that. I am still so astounded by how many points this team scores.
Yeah, such a dramatic jump from last year where they're the worst team in the end or in the red zone compared to this year. And
they're the best team. As of right now, they are the top team in red zone scoring for touchdowns.
So that's a big thumbs up to Ken Austin and Tommy Condell to figure that out in the offseason. All right, now going on to my question is, will Aaron Rodgers be in the NFL next season?
Yes, he will get a shot. Whether he stays or not is who knows, but yeah, he will definitely parlay his success into an NFL opportunity. And I say that because we've seen players, especially receivers, who haven't put up the numbers that Rodgers had, make it to the NFL. And my big example there is Dontrell Inman. Dontrell Inman was a pretty good receiver with the Argos. Over two seasons with Toronto, he had 50 catches for 803 yards and 5 touchdowns in 2012. And then he had 50 catches for 739 yards and 6 touchdowns in 2013. Aaron Rodgers so far this year has 46 catches for 812 yards and 7 touchdowns. So Inman never scored anywhere near as many touchdowns as Rodgers scored. And Rodgers has more receiving yards so far this season in, 9 games? Than Inman had in any season where he played. I don't know exactly how many games he played, but anywhere between, say, 14 and 18 games. So, yeah, Rodgers will be on an NFL roster come training camp. Whether he makes an NFL team, I don't know. He does seem to be a little small. Inman is a tall receiver, but yeah, no doubt in my mind he's getting an NFL opportunity.
Yeah, I'd say that he's going to be at a training camp next year. He kind of reminds me of Montreal receiver last year, Carter.
Daron Carter.
Yes, he kind of reminds me of him. Maybe he doesn't have his height, but I don't know, just the way he runs and catches the ball, he kind of reminds me of him. So yeah, I'd say that he's going to get a shot in the NFL next year. His contract is up, is it not, probably?
I'm fairly certain, yeah. He was cut in training camp by the Red Blacks, and I think he signed a 1+1 with Calgary because he never made it. He was still considered a rookie. He never played in a game. So, yeah, I'm pretty sure this is – everyone seems to be talking about it. Like, this is a big talk on social media, I find, with Rodgers, because it seems like everyone but me knew that he'd be great this year. I still keep beating myself. Like, you know how we make fun of you for your Andrew Harris is overrated thing?
Yeah.
My cross to bear is saying Aaron Rodgers would disappoint this year. I've been 100% wrong, and I will cop to that every time we bring his name up because – not only has it been a treat to watch him play, but it's one of those times when I don't really mind being wrong because he's just been awesome. He's a fun guy. And that, 2 weeks ago where he had the Hail Mary touchdown catch? Like, that was just awesome.
That was phenomenal, and he's just, game after game, he keeps piling up the yards and the touchdowns, so he's a great player.
Yeah, absolutely. I was completely and utterly wrong about him, and just a fun guy to watch, and let's take advantage of getting a chance to see him because he probably will not be with us next season. So let's move on to Labor Day Classic. Monday, 1:00, Ticats, Argos. Oh man, it's a battle for first place. I don't know the last time that we got into Labor Day where both these teams were atop the East standings. I hate this team, you hate this team, but these two teams battling when it matters, it just makes this game so much more special.
Yeah, you can't ask for much better. I mean, you got the East Labor Day Classic, both teams are 6-3. You got the West, where Calgary's 7-2, Edmonton 6-3, so it's both battles for first place. The intensity is going to be through the roof. Crowds are going to be going nuts, so I am pumped for next Monday. It's going to be a great afternoon of football.
I think that the atmosphere at Tim Hortons Field next Monday is going to be electric. I think it's going to be playoff caliber atmosphere. That stadium is going to be loud. It's going to be rocking, and I don't have a pause at all to say I think the Ticats are going to slaughter Toronto. I think they're going to take what happened against Montreal, eat it up, and just take it all out on the Argos. I think Toronto's in for a very, very long afternoon.
I'm not sure if I can go that far. I think it might be closer than you think, but I see where you're coming from. You know, it was a tough loss last week against the Alouettes. The Argos are coming off a big loss to the Eskimos. Maybe they got put down a peg in that game, and it's downhill from here on out for the Argos. So I hope you're right, and they give them a pounding.
Well, we're going to know probably by the end of the first quarter what this game's going to be like. It seems like whenever Hamilton doesn't perform super effectively in the first frame, that the game is either close or they lose. But if they jump out to these big leads, they had a big lead against Winnipeg. They had a big lead against Winnipeg again. They had a big lead against BC. They took a big lead against Toronto when these two teams played at the beginning of August. If they get out to these monster leads, the Argos, like I said earlier, the Argos are not making these comebacks against a good squad. So I don't see a way. I know we sat here last week and said we didn't really see a way that Hamilton would lose to Montreal, and they did. I don't see any way that this Ticat team doesn't bounce back from what was, I've said consistently, a really, really poor performance against Montreal and just take it to Toronto. Look, the defensive line is going to be hungry. They're going to want to prove what happened against Montreal was an aberration and not a harbinger of things to come. The offensive line is going to want to exert their will against Toronto pass rush and keep Caleros clean. They're not going to want to give up, you know, half a dozen sacks once again. I think the running game might even get sparked because I think a guy like Grigsby has he plays with a chip on his shoulder, and I think he's going to be pissed off that he didn't perform very well. And I think Picard Grant is expected to be back. Mm-hmm. I don't see any way in which the Ticats stumble in this one. I think this is their bounce back game. And I think I'm more interested in seeing how they do the following Friday after Labor Day against Toronto, which we'll talk about, you know, on the next show, obviously. I can't find it in me to say that the Argos really have a hope in hell of winning this game.
Yeah, if Hamilton stomps on their throat in the first quarter, they're not coming back. They're not coming back against this defense. Noel Thorpe's defense gave them a lot of trouble last week, but Casey Crehan is not Noel Thorpe, so I don't think we have to worry about six sacks this week. I think the O-line is going to have a much, much better game. They'll have something to prove. I think they have to cut down on the penalties again. We've been talking about this for a couple weeks now. I think they had 12 penalties against Montreal. You know, that's not a huge number, but it's still not a good number. I want to see that dropped by about 5 penalties a game. I want to be under 10. I think that'll help them a lot. I think they got to run the ball more with Grigsby. You know, Grigsby's a talented dude. Give him some opportunities to make some plays. You know, three attempts is not enough. I know that they've been winning without a running game, but they're going to have to get it going eventually. So give the ball to Grigsby and let him do his thing.
So should we make our bold predictions for this game then?
We shall. I'll go first.
As always, you go first.
All right. I will predict that the O-line will allow 0 sacks.
0 sacks. I like it. Defense scores twice this week against Toronto.
Okay.
I'm not going to say who. I'm not going to say how. But they're scoring twice. And they're scoring early. And, yeah, we're kicking their ass. I'm saying it. We're kicking their ass on Monday.
I like that, too. Questions?
Questions. So, let me start with a question I got on the comment section of Three Down Nation last week. This is a different one. Usually we get sort of opinion questions. This is more of a fact-based question. The commenter's name was Mark, not the Mark that's, you know, Fender guy that our buddy also works for me. This was a totally different Mark, and he had a question as it pertains to quarterbacks. And here's what he said. I was always of the understanding that the three players designated to play quarterback could not play another position, even in an emergency. I have this year heard about a third-string quarterback from Edmonton playing special teams. He's talking about Jordan Lynch. Jordan Lynch is on the punt coverage unit for the Eskimos. Yet a few years ago, I recall Hamilton having a third-string quarterback that at the time Danny McManus said was an excellent punter, but he could not be used in that capacity. Have the rules changed somewhere along the line? I have the answer to this question, but instead of just answering it and having you sit there in silence, what do you think about this? What do you think maybe the rule is or maybe where this Mark gentleman is wrong? Or what do you think? Let's get an answer from you first, and then I'll tell you exactly what the answer is.
See, I don't really have an answer to that. I'm not sure about the rule. Like you said, I know that Lynch has been covering punts, and then he's even made some tackles, so they must allow quarterbacks to play different positions. I'm not sure if they changed it, so I don't really have a lot of perspective on that. So maybe you should just shoot out the answer.
I did not know the answer to this, so I put this out to Fender guy, Mark, our buddy Mark. And, you know, he's a rules expert, he's a numbers guy. I said, here's the question, can you provide an answer? So he, you know, thumbed through his rule book and found an answer for me. And it is Rule 6, Section 4, Article 4, Note 4, Article 5. I don't know how the hell he finds anything, because that, you know, made my eyes cross just reading that. So what it says is, designated quarterbacks prior to the game. A team is required to designate three players who shall be permitted to alternate for each other during the game at the quarterback position exclusively. Not more than one such player may be in the game at any time, and none of the three can enter the game as a member of Team B, Team B being the defense. Note, for the purposes of this Article 5, the duties of the quarterback position may include punting, place kicking, and kicking off. If a team designates three quarterbacks for a game, the player designated as the third quarterback shall not be eligible for kicking duties. Now, in layman's terms, what Mark said is that by his interpretation, that means that the number one and number two quarterbacks can punt and or kick, and all three can play on offense, but only one at a time, and all three can play on special teams coverage, but again, only one on the field at a time. So, whether this is a new rule or whether this is an existing rule that, you know, none of us knew about, because how often do quarterbacks play on punt coverage team? That was the answer that I got. So I hope that's good enough for Mark. I hope he listens next week and that answers his question. So now it's your turn. What questions do you have for me, my friend?
Okay, we got one from Fender Guy. Which former head coach and current coordinator do you see getting another shot at head coach, if any?
This was kind of tough because I was going through sort of who has head coaching experience. I know Mark gave us Jeff Reinbold, George Cortez, and Rick Stubler. And I don't really think any of those three will be a head coach again. If I had to pick one of those, I think maybe Cortez. You know, he's the offensive coordinator in BC, and Jeff Tedford is the head coach there. He's, you know, not exactly a spry young man, so maybe if Tedford steps down, Cortez takes over. Maybe if, you know, something unfortunate happens and Tedford has to step down, Cortez seems like the obvious sort of choice to take over on an interim basis even. But other than that, I don't really think there's any, you know, coordinators out there. Cavis Reed, maybe. He's special teams coordinator in Montreal right now. Maybe he's someone who might get another shot down the line. I don't think his tenure in Edmonton was as bad as a lot of people make it out to be. Yeah, there was that whole consequences silliness. But, you know, his first year there, I believe, was 2011. And he got them to the West Final. And it wasn't until Eric Tillman decided to make one of the worst trades in the history of professional sports that team really sort of went downhill. So, yeah, you know what? I'm going to say Cavis Reed probably gets a shot somewhere down the line with another franchise. And you know what? Maybe it's Montreal. Maybe Jim Popp steps down at the end of the year and Cavis Reed gets the head coaching job in Montreal.
Yeah, that's a possibility. I don't see any of those guys getting it. I mean, you got Reinbold. You know, he was a head coach such a long time ago. And, you know, he's done a fantastic job as special teams coordinator, but I don't see him climbing the ranks again.
I don't think he wants to be a head coach, really. I think he's kind of happy being, like, I know he was flirting with, I think it was Simon Fraser last year, being maybe moving over there to be the head coach. I think he's happy sort of not being the head guy. I think he likes his job. I think he loves being here. The guy is super positive, and like, I'm a huge fan of his. I know I've said before that I was not very fond of his hiring, but he's won me over a billion times. I just don't see him really wanting to be a head coach again, especially at the pro level.
Cortez, he had his shot in Hamilton. Didn't go so well. Even though the offense was great that year, he just doesn't seem to have what it takes to make all the decisions as head coach. So, and he's getting up there in age, so I don't see him getting another shot. You know, Cavis Reed, I don't think I see that either. So I just don't see any of those guys getting another shot at head coach. And Stubler, you know, he was Toronto. It didn't go too well either. So I'm going to say nobody. All right. Now, question from B. Broom. Brian, with the guaranteed pay for vets approaching, who do you think gets cut or traded around the league?
Maybe Jamel Richardson.
Didn't he get cut?
No, I think he's on the six-game injured list. I think instead of cutting him and Taj Smith, I think instead of cutting them, I think they kept them on the six-game injured list. If I'm wrong, I'm sure someone will correct me. I'm pretty sure I say that probably once an episode. But yeah, so maybe Taj Smith, someone like that. I know they're on the sixth game. Their money doesn't count towards the cap. But if you're not going to use them and they're not actually hurt, why the hell are you keeping them around? And with Saskatchewan being the sort of dumpster fire that they are right now, I could see them getting rid of a bunch of veteran players and sort of going younger. Alex Suber is – no, not Alex Suber. Is it Alex Suber that's in? Or is it Jonathan Hefney? No, Hefney's in Montreal.
Yeah.
It's Suber that's in Saskatchewan. Maybe he's the guy that could go. I'm just trying to think of players on, like, bad teams. I don't really know if anyone will get cut. I don't think anyone will get traded. Veteran players, I don't really see that happening. But Yeah, maybe someone out in Saskatchewan like a Smith or a Richardson or, yeah, or someone like that.
I was thinking Saskatchewan too. That's all I could really think of because it's such a, you know, everyone else could still make the playoffs, so they're still all in the hunt. So, you know, maybe, you know, Sinceri gets cut again, or I don't know, Alex Hall's kind of been underperforming, and maybe Backenridge, or, you know, just anyone from Saskatchewan. You just never know because it seems like they're retooling in Ryderville. So
yeah, it's time for them to go young. This is a lost season, so let's see what they have. This would be a smart time. They're going to get these players some real game time, not, you know, practice time, not half a quarter in a preseason game. This is live bullets. They're going to be facing teams that are trying to win, not just evaluate players. This is where they can sort of see what they have in some of their young players. I think that, yeah, the veterans either shouldn't play, or, you know, they can't go with all rookies, obviously. But yeah, Saskatchewan seems to be the only team, like you said, that really sort of has anyone that could sort of be let go because they're out of it. And it's time for them to play their young kids and see what they have going into the future.
Now we got one from Canes Eagles 1. We kind of touched on this a bit, but after a performance like Friday or Thursday night, how well do you see the Ticats bouncing back?
Well, I said they're going to kick the living out of the Arcos, so I see them bouncing back big time.
Yeah, I think they're going to have a great game on Monday, so that pretty much answers that. From USFL Tecmo, any bold predictions for second half of the CFL season?
Is saying there's going to be a crossover a bold prediction? Like, I've already said that before, so I've kind of gone on record with that one already. Do you have any?
I have three quarterbacks will throw for over 5,000 yards.
Ooh, okay, so Zach Caleros.
Yeah.
I'm going to say you think Trevor Harris is going to start the whole season in Toronto, so I think he would be a second player.
There was four, and then I crossed Trevor Harris off because I thought that Ricky Ray might be coming in late in the season. I think there's a couple on pace for 5,000. Caleros, Burris, and Bo Levi Mitchell.
Oh, Bo Levi Mitchell. And Burris. Yeah. Burris is a surprise, but I guess, you know, if Ottawa keeps playing well, he's not coming out. They're not going to sit him to see what the youngsters have there. They're not Saskatchewan.
Yeah, I think Burris is maybe at 2,500 and Claros is around 26. Then Bo Levi Mitchell is like 24.5. So, yeah.
They're all kind of in the area.
Yeah, so three quarterbacks pass for over 5,000 yards, which wouldn't be that bold in the old days of the CFL. But recently it's been, you know, it's been tough to get the 5,000 yards. Maybe one player does it a year, but not. I don't think anyone did it last year, so that's mine.
I don't think anyone did it last year either. Did anyone even do it the year before?
There might have been one, but I'm not positive.
I know Burris' first year in Hamilton, he threw for 5,000 yards. Because he set the team record for passing yards. It was 5,200. And so, like, he had an awesome year passing the ball. Okay, I'm going to look up some stats here just to... Okay, Ricky Ray led the league in passing last year with 4,595. So no 5,000-yard passer in 2014. No. Kevin Glenn was number two, and he didn't even throw for 4,000 yards. So down year for quarterbacks. Burris led in 2013, threw for just under 5,000, 4,925.
There you go.
So there was none there. I know in 2012, Burris threw for 52 something or other, so we don't have to look there. Oh, two quarterbacks that year. I'm sorry. Two quarterbacks threw for 5,000 yards in 2012. Burris was 5,367. Ah, it's even more than I thought.
Wow.
And Calvillo threw for 5,082. 2011 was Calvillo. Okay, now we're getting to Calvillo. He threw for 5,000 yards pretty much every year, so...
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Kevin Glenn threw for 5,106 in 2010 with Hamilton. Wow. I guess I knew that because he had the record before Burris had it. So, all right. So, yeah, there's been a lot of 5,000 yards passers, but we haven't had one since 2012. So, to get three in 1 year, that's a pretty bold prediction, my friend.
Yep. So, it looks like those rules have been paying off a bit for the offense.
So, was that the last one you had?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so I got one more, and again, it pertains to the Riders, so we kind of touched on it earlier when we were talking about how Corey Chamblin got fired, but a mutual friend of ours, Miss Jacqueline, sent me in a two-part question. It says, if Chamblin kept Smith out of the game for talking back or arguing with him, is that the right way to deal with it? Could he have dealt with it in a better way? That's part one of the question. So let's answer that, and then we'll get into part two. What do you think of... Obviously, we've discussed that we both think it was an idiotic decision to bench Brett Smith. What do you think sort of about this rumor that he kind of sassed Chamblin after he pulled him out of the game?
You know, I think he has a right to sass him. You know, it's just a stupid decision. Even if he did, you know, that just shows he has some fire in his belly. You know, guy wants to play. He wants to produce. You know, he threw an interception in the end zone, and you know, so what? That happens. You know, shit happens. Cortez got a lot of the blame last year for whenever the running backs fumbled the ball, they'd yank him out of the game. So maybe that was more Chamberlain than Cortez. So Chamberlain's ego, I was talking about it earlier, his ego was getting in the way. Don't talk back to me. He took him out of the game and cost him the game, cost him a victory probably. So just a dumb move all around.
I find it funny that you mentioned the yanking of the running backs after fumbles last year, because when he was pulled after the interception, I was like, this is that all over again. And last year, it was Cortez that sort of got thrown under the bus, and you know, everyone kind of thought it was his decision to pull the fumbling running backs, and yet we still see the same sort of silliness this year. And that Smith thing was just asinine, but you know, we don't really need to go into that much more because we both sort of agree on that. But what about, is that the right way to deal with it? And could he have dealt with it in a better way? What do you think about that?
Well, maybe you just talk to the guy, you know? You don't have to pull him for the rest of the game. He's been playing well for your team. It's not the right way to deal with it. Sit him down, give him a talking to, say, you know, I run the show around here, but just calm down and we'll get you back in there, kid, you know? So, no, it's the wrong decision.
And here's part two of the question. Would it be justified if the game was already a blowout, and can you pick your punishment methods based on the scoreboard? Now, I find this interesting because a few weeks ago, Odell Willis was yanked essentially from a game when Edmonton was in Ottawa, and Willis took a selfish, stupid penalty. And there was a bit of a outcry. It's like, yeah, you can make your point, but at what point is the point you're making detrimental to the team? So I'm not sure if you can base your punishment methods on what the score is at the time, but I can't really justify the decision in any situation, winning, losing, getting blown out, down by a little, up by a lot. It was just a dumb decision all ways around. Where do you sort of stand on the idea of switching up punishments based on what the score is at the time of the game?
Yeah, well, the thing with the Willis is it hurt his team on the field. Smith just said something to Chamberlain. It didn't cause a penalty on the field or anything like that. So, and they already know what Sinceri has, which is nothing. I mean, they already gave up on him. They cut him already this year and had to bring him back because of injuries. So who cares what the score is? Let's see what Smith has. Keep him in the game. He's a young quarterback. He could be your future. You know, it was just no. Just dumb. Stupid, dumb.
I think at some point, I think it was like the halftime interview, that Chamberlain came out and said that Sinceri gives them the best chance to win. I mean, I can't remember. I just remember hearing those words, and I was just stunned silent. This is a guy that they, like you said, they cut in training camp. He wasn't good enough to make this roster. He's only back because they've suffered two catastrophic injuries at the quarterback position. And yet you're telling me that at the midway point of the season, in your ninth game, in the 10th week of the year, that he gives you the best chance to win? Mm. Oh, man. I might miss the fact that he's fired now, and all that unintentional comedy that he could bring out on occasions, because that was one of the stupidest statements after one of the stupidest moves that I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah, I think there'll be, I'm sure there's people that still stand behind Chamberlain, but I'm sure there'll be a lot of happy Riders fans seeing him go.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's people out there who think that the 2003 Ticats weren't as bad as their record.
Yeah.
There are people out there who just refuse to look at their teams objectively or refuse to criticize them, and, you know, that's a whole other topic for a whole other day. So with that, we are out of here, folks. Don't forget that you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you want to have one of your questions read and have Mike and I discuss it, like we always tend to do, we love the questions. I know you do. This was Mike's idea, actually, when we were starting the show. This was his baby, so I know he loves it. I love it, too. So if you want to get those questions in here and get them answered, you can hit us both up on Twitter. Mike, as always, give them your Twitter handle.
Mike_Ticats.
Yeah. He hasn't changed it to Mike_Esks yet, but give it a couple months.
No.
And you can find me at JoshSmith_82. And you can always post your comments and your questions on 3Down Nation. I like to get feedback. Mike likes to get feedback. Has anyone called you stupid or an idiot yet?
No one's told me I suck yet, so still waiting for that.
That is Podski Wee Wee for this week. I am Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.